best way to deal with the quiz is to, I mean, quiz, not quiz, exam, but, you know, kind of like a quiz. Pull up all your PowerPoints, basically, right? Muscle, circulation that we just covered, most of it, behavior, sensory, endocrine. Those are your sections, right? So the point was, what are we covering? But if you have old tests right now and you have questions, let's go for it. Is there some questions? Because if you have a question, somebody else probably has a question. Number four question says, please list the anatomical pathway and safety actions in the path from a sound wave producing the movement in the oval window to the point one could perceive sound in the central nervous system. Isn't that a great question? So what would you do? So that was a summer question. Remember, this exam, we cannot have a lot of open response questions because we only have an hour and 15 minutes, so most of it's multiple choice that I'll make, and a few open response questions that'll be kind of short. But let's think about that. So that was back in sensory, right? So if we went to sensory chapter, for example, we could then pull that one up. We could go to the ear. Where's the ear? And the ear. So, how do we hear? How do we hear? So remember with the hearing, we had, first of all, the ear, right? And we think about what the different parts of the ear do. How do we tell movement of our head? What's the main part of our movement? Is it the snail-like structure?
No.
No. What's the snail-like structure for?
Hearing.
Hearing, right? Like the snail, the sound thing we told you about, the corny thing, you know, you blow into. So the conculus for hearing. Semicircular canal is for equilibrium. What about your static position? You're holding your head here, or you bent sideways and you held it. How would you know your head is sideways? You're not moving it, you're just holding it. Remember the lobster kind of thing? We'll get to your question. Remember the lobster? These little statoliths that sit on the mucous membrane, like a little stone, that then deflect the hairs one way. If the animal moves this way or that way, it's going to deflect here or there because of the gravity. What do we have? We have something very similar, right? Remember this picture? These little otoliths that are on the top? Sitting on top of a gelatin mass. Sitting on top of a gelatin mass that's on top of the little hair cells. It's no different than that lobster, right? And where are these found? Where are these found? These are found in the utriculus and sacculus, right? And these little otoliths sit there. And it's just like the lobster, or like little lobsters. Right? And they sit there and measure. It's no different. It's a little like stone that takes the gravity up in the utriculus and sacculus for static position. Dynamic positions, the semicircular canals, right? And a snail-like structure for hearing. So let's go through that snail-like structure. Okay, right here. Okay. All right, so here we go. So we should know sound wave. Like you're hearing me, probably tuned out by now. But anyways, sound wave, vibration, right, goes to the tympan. Yes?
You went really fast. The semicircular canals are the equilibrium.
Uh-huh. Movement.
And the cubicle and sacral are for head position?
Yeah, static position. Yeah. Remember, I think I mentioned in class that basketball player that hit their, they were playing basketball and they fell just one time in practice, hit their head, and now they couldn't drive for like 6 months, had to drop out of classes, can't read the textbook because their eyes are moving back and forth. And what they finally found out is that her utriculus and sacculus kind of came apart, and that she can't have proprioception. So she, actually, they go to the rehab center that's over on
or Sales Road, or whatever that road is, out to the airport, right? What's that rehab? Cardinal Hill. And they actually have it where they have to stay in this position for so long to try to heal that back up, where actually it can re-heal again. And then to get your equilibrium, to get your static position down. Because it's like being seasick all the time, right? And that test for the equilibrium, you know, I think I mentioned, they can put hot water or cold water in the ear, and you will have a stereotypic type of behavioral response, because that endolymph will start to move, and you think your head's moving around, so you have a type of response to balance. So it's a standard neurological type of test to make sure things are working. But for sound now, we have that sound wave in the air, hits that tympanic membrane, and then that tympanic membrane goes to three smallest bones in your body, malleus and castapes, or just say the three bones. So it's a mechanical transformation through the air to bones that are moving, right? And if those bones are having some kind of problems, that then you don't hear well. And then that bones go to the oval window and then start a fluid movement. So now we're having from air wave to a fluid wave. That fluid wave moves around the cochlea of the inner ear. And then if that fluid was a closed pipe, you wouldn't get that to really go through very well. So by having another window on the other side, like another membrane, you can dissipate that wave, and that's the round window that's down here. So now that fluid wave can be dissipated, so you can get that wave to go all the way through that snail-like structure. And the main point we wanted to remember, I didn't want you to have to know the nitty-gritty detail of this, but the idea, the standard kind of response would be, that fluid moves for that these tube that wraps around, but there's another tube inside of that snail-like structure, which has this fluid that's inside here. And having that fluid move back and forth up there in the top one causes this membrane in the middle to move, which then causes this fluid to move, but it causes this tectorial membrane. That's the key element. So think of your hand as the tectorial membrane, these fingers as the hair cells underneath. If this is moving back and forth, it bends those hair cells underneath. So the tectorial membrane picking up that wave moves those hairs underneath that then stimulates. Remember, those hair cells are modified sensory structures, and a single hair cell is a single cell with like little fingers coming through, and you have a kinocilium, a stericilium. That's all one cell, the plasma membrane going around it. If it bends towards the kinocilium, it depolarizes, bends away, you know, it hyperpolarizes it. But the main point was that you move that fluid, for that kind of question, you move the fluid that then causes a mechanical deformation of the tectorial membrane that then moves the hair cells. Depending on that wave frequency that goes around, you actually have a tonotopic type of arrangement with different frequencies, high being at the beginning and low over here, because the fluid wave comes around and then goes back out, oval window to the round window. And then those neurons that detect that, think of all those hairs all throughout here, those neurons that come out are arranged, and they keep that same arrangement that then goes into the brainstem. And if you record it in the brainstem with electrodes, you could actually know, if I record right there, that's going to be high frequency response. If I just move it over a little bit more, that's going to be low frequency response. Because it keeps the term is tonotopic arrangement for the neural input into the brain. It's no different than like that homunculus that we covered. Remember when we went to the outreach center, the two-point discrimination and the shape of the human body? It's like that same kind of arrangement. Things are kept in an arrangement so we can make sense out of it. So that's the tonotopic arrangement for that. Okay? Another burning question on old exams, multiple choice exams, other questions. Now, some of those old exams, right, like the summer ones, were, you know, much more open response questions, but still, those are great study guides, because you look through there, can I answer those questions, right? Can I do that? So if we look through some of these, like this sensory one, how would you go through these to study? Well, let's go to the beginning of it. So I would take each one of the PowerPoints. Do not do Adderall to try to stay awake all night. That's not a good thing, okay? Because you're going to come in groggy, and then you won't think right, and you're going to be all hyper, all right? So just go through these and kind of think, well, did we talk about you know, these different receptors. Yeah, we talked about some of them. Some of them we talked more about. What was the thermal receptors? Not much, you know, but, you know, like snakes have a thermal sensation. You had hot, cold, you know, on your... We did that kind of test in here, remember? You know, red and blue. And, of course, we can't ask everything on this test because it would take forever, right? So there's, you're going to overstudy no matter what. You're going to study, you know, more things than what you can possibly be tested on. That's just the way it goes. Proprioceptors, we talked about this. Where are your proprioceptors? Proprioception is limbs with response to your body. Where's your proprioception? How do you detect proprioception? How do you know when you close your eyes where your arm is? Anybody? How do you detect? Think like you're a little crayfish. Everything comes back
fibers.
To a crayfish. Yes, spindle fibers, muscle spindle fibers, right? And what does that relate to, too? Well, we talked about... I could just stay there. We talked about these kind of things, the muscle receptor organ in the crayfish abdomen, right? And that we said that there's ones that respond to phasic and tonic type of stretch, and that that was analogous to your muscle spindle because there are two muscle fibers in your muscle spindle, just like that crayfish abdomen. One detects static position when you stretch it. It continues to fire. The other one only really responds when you initially stretch it. So, you know, that was therefore we're like crayfish. Okay, so muscle spindles, much like that, right? So proprioception. I mean, that's where I would go with that type of question that we had on there. So if you look back at those other ones, I mean, what's some of the main things? Is that primary receptors, you know, your sensory endings, what do they, how do you detect touch? What's the key element? How do you transduce the mechanical stimulation to?
Conformational change.
Stretch activated ion channels, right? You know, they detect the stretch. And then we've talked about those over and over. No different than the hair cell in the ear. Those are stretch activated ion channels. Some movement, right? Like pressure osmolarity in your hypothalamus, too. It's stretch activated ion channels. Okay, so we talked a little bit about vision. If we go through this, you know. What were some of the main things that we talked about with vision? Well, the two main differences in the comparative aspect we talked about, insect eyes, crustacean type, and mammalian eyes. What's the main difference? What's the unit of vision for the insect eye? You know, it's got these packets, right? What's the ommatidia, right? And those individual cells that are in there that detect light, when light hits it, does it depolarize or hyperpolarize? Depolarizes in an insect. Now, in our eyes, what's the primary structures in the eye that detects light? Rods and cones. Which one for color?
Cones.
See. And then what happens when light shines to that? Does it depolarize or hyperpolarize?
Hyperpolarize.
So in the dark, is that neuron releasing more transmitter or less transmitter in the dark? Rods and cones. It's releasing more transmitter. See, it's kind of confusing, right? Because it's without the stimulus, it seems more active. So when we get to the rods and cones, so we just talked about the ear. When we got to the vision, see, there's lots of slides, but, you know, we'll talk about taste here in a second. When we got to the vision, we talked about, let's say, you know, rods and cones go through these other cells and then comes out the optic nerve. And remember the point that we did at the outreach center with the blind spot? Why do we have a blind spot?
Optic nerve leaving.
Optic nerve leaving, so you can't have any rods and cones, right? And so that was that part. And then these, so we're getting more transmission going on in the dark. When the light's activated, what happens? What happens with light on the rods and cones? What kind of current's going on in the dark? Why are we getting transmitter in the dark? What's causing the cell to be depolarized in the dark? What generally causes cells to be depolarized? Sodium, right? So we're having a sodium current in the dark. So it's called the dark current, not the dark fader. So sodium current in the dark. Well, it's through that G-coupled protein that we close it when light hits it. So this phosphodiesterase degrades its cyclic GMP, and then it causes the sodium channels to close. So you need the cyclic GMP to keep the sodium channels open, but when light activates these, it activates this enzyme, and it causes it to decrease. So then the sodium channels close, And just like we've talked about with other neurons, you know, if the sodium equilibrium is way up here and potassium is way down here, and you're not, now you're not going towards the sodium anymore, and you close those channels, where are you going to go? You're going to go towards the potassium. So you hyperpolarize, you decrease the amount of transmitter release with light. In that eye structure, what were some of the main points with the eye structure in here? We didn't have to memorize all that anatomy, right? But the main point was, how do you detect edges really well? How do you detect light when it comes in that it might be stronger here than here? You might get a little background light right here, but how is it that you can detect
lateral inhibition?
Well, yes, lateral inhibition. That was first described in the invertebrate eye, the horseshoe crab. Got a Nobel Prize. Then they could understand how that works in our eye. So if you can kind of go back and think about the main things that we talked about, that, you know, that helps. That's probably the main things that we hit, right? So there's lots of figures, lots of PowerPoints, but some of it is redundant, right? And the main points that, you know, we've talked about. So if we go back to the other part in this chapter, so if you just kind of go through these in the chapter, I don't think, we didn't talk about all the different animal eyes pretty much, but the main point of a vertebrate versus invertebrate eyes. What else did we talk about? We talked about olfaction a bit, right? And taste.
There's a question on one of the old exams about two researchers that researched infant eyes compared to
So on some of the exams we had more time on this, but we did talk a little bit about in class. This year we didn't spend a lot of time on that. But Ubel and Wiesel got the Nobel Prize for looking at kitten eyes in monkey eyes, basically, early on. And they found that, you know, competition for that, I think this was in the behavior chapter, for the lateral geniculate. So the optic nerve goes to the lateral geniculate, and then the right eye and left eye, different parts of it, are competing for that same site. So they want to make synapses on the target. But if the right eye isn't working well, like they could patch that up, this one doesn't have the activity, and this one then takes over that space. Now, if that happens and continues to happen through development, when the fetus, you know, goes born, baby born, starts to see things, then if that continues throughout that child's early life, then you can't change anymore. So it's past a critical period. But this is why some people that have a, you know, what they call a lazy eye, it's common in eyes, it's the muscles in the side of the eye, the six muscles might be a little loose or so. Babies don't have a focus, but then after a while they should be able to focus, and that's why the pediatrician goes back and forth with their finger to make sure they can focus. They used to say, let's not have a surgery on those muscles until later in life when it's maybe a teenager, and we'll correct this problem just for aesthetic reasons. Well, they found out that it's too late for the connections in the brain. It's past the critical period. So what they showed with kittens and monkeys is that there's that critical period, they need to correct that earlier on. So they would go in and shorten those rectal muscles on the eye around there, and so they could actually focus, and then those projections would be right, and so they could have spatial depth, for example. Ubel and Wiesel did those kind of work. They're pioneers in that field. So that was the old question. We didn't really get into it that much, but the point was that there's a critical period in neuronal development and connections in the brain. You have those for hearing, vision, connections all together, right? So that was the point there. Taste. What did we cover about taste? Did we want you to memorize all these different receptors and the different types that, some, you know, sour was a hydrogen ion?
No,
but what did we want to remember? Just as an example, what did we want to get out of this? So this helps you reduce that stress of studying all those wonderful PowerPoints. What was the main thing?
Chemoreceptors?
Yeah, that's a chemoreceptor, and the generally, most of them end up with depolarization. There's some that might, you know, block, but generally that they depolarize. Some are ion channels, some work through second messengers. You know, it was the main point of that, right? So on the test, you know, you look through your multiple choice questions, you can eliminate a lot of them that don't make sense and get the main ones, and you're going to finish in 35 minutes. Wait, I got a few open response questions on the last page. I got to, you know, finish those off, and you're done by 40 minutes, and you got an A. Okay? So this is the point. If you really kind of, you know, hit it, you're going to be good. I'm not trying to make tricky questions or anything. And I'm lazy, so I like to take them from old exams. But I got to make some new ones just in case. you know, give you some more things to think about. Okay, so what it was the main points were just, you know, ion channels, second messengers, usually they depolarize. All right. So we got through this, you know, we didn't talk too much more about it, but there's a high stem cell turnover in the olfactory system, as you can imagine, because they get damaged a lot. So there's a high turnover, and this is where they first thought they could understand stem cells and regeneration in the nervous system. And there's so much emphasis early on in olfaction because these cells could regenerate. And so there was a lot to do with regeneration repair. And then we went through vision. We just went through that, the main points. Not too much there, really. Lateral inhibition, we told you we didn't have to memorize all these pathways and things, right? But we did, when we talked about at the outreach center, we showed you those brains. And remember, the back part of the brain was the occipital cortex. So if you had head, you know, beating your head against the wall and you bruised the back part of your brain, you might have visual problems. I mean, the main kind of things. We didn't go through all the different regions of the brain. This is not, you know, we can't do everything. And then we talked about like omatidia and the retina, but we didn't go through all that stuff. It was just there. And the horseshoe crab was kind of really neat because this is where it was all worked out with lateral inhibition and understanding these processes. Thermal, we talked about rattlesnakes, right? Sweetwater, you can all come to my hometown, West Texas. We can go rattlesnake hunting, right? Pretty cool. Pain pathways, we did talk about pain a bit, right? And the general aspect, of course, there's some subtle differences to lots of different things here, but what did we talk about with pain? And this is important in today, and this is why we mentioned it in class, too, because what's the big problem across the country? Opioids, right? And addiction and opioid problems that are going on, right? So we should kind of understand a little bit about that. I think that's an important issue to understand pain. And what are endorphins? You know, the runner's high, right? You run every day. You don't run. It's a rainy day and you don't want to run. You're going to feel miserable because you're not releasing your endogenous morphine, your endorphins. But they can also help you with pain modulation, right?
You know about pain? Substance P,
and substance P is very important. You can tell me if there's new changes to this. You're working on it. Is this still a good diagram?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's think. Remember, nociceptive is pain, right? Like if you pinch your skin, right? Remember we did the touch. But when we did the two-point discrimination, we weren't painful. But if you stab that into your skin, it would be painful, right? You'd be activating these pain pathways, and you'd release substance P, right? But if you wanted to modulate that pain, or medications, what do you take? You take opioids. What do? They generally, the idea is that it would decrease substance P release. How do they work? Receptors on the presynaptic nerve terminal inhibiting substance P release. If you want to talk about where is all this going on? In the spinal cord, right? This is dorsal horn. Remember sensory input, dorsal ganglion going into the dorsal horn, and then you have descending control that can modulate this in the periphery, from the peripheral input in the dorsal horn area, connections from higher centers releasing endogenous opioids like endorphins. But if you take medication, it's blocking that, and I don't feel any pain, I feel great, you know, I want some more, and the addiction process goes on, okay? So this is a major issue, so maybe that should be something good to emphasize. And then that then triggers up to the brain to either monitor that pain or not monitor that pain. And we did talk a little bit about capsaicin, right? Capsaicin is thought, in some aspects, was thought to actually destroy nociceptive neurons, and some of the studies that were done a lot by Koreans actually in Houston and in South Korea, there's lots of studies in pain fiber modulation where they've injected capsaicin into like the pads of mice and rats, and they've actually showed they decreased the number of sensory neurons, but now they would walk on a hot plate and actually burn their feet because they don't detect the pain anymore. And this is some of the ideas of eating hot food all the time, that you might be able to get hotter and hotter food. And that there's some interesting studies, and we talked to Brad Taylor about this, you know, in the sense that people that have hot food all the time, would they have less sensitivity to pain themselves, right? Or maybe childbirthing, things like that. It'd be kind of interesting to do more bigger studies like that, meta studies. So this is kind of interesting to think about. And then What else did we talk about? We talked about electroreception a little bit, about animals that can have an electric field around them, but if something interferes, this is how an animal can detect something's around them, right? So by that electric field, that's an interesting little organ. Magnetoreceptors, what did we talk about? Migratory birds, basically, right? Migration with Earth magnetic fields, but we didn't get into all the nitty-gritty details, just that some animals can detect magnetoreception. That's that chapter. So, you know, now you've just knocked off the sensory chapter. Not so bad, right?
Right.
And now we have some other chapters, like the behavior chapter. What did we cover in behavior chapter?
Where are we?
You know, so you finished this chapter, basically. So then go to your other chapters that you've opened up. You know, sensory, endocrine, I know there's a lot there. Which one's this? Is this muscle? We had muscle. Behavior. Was there a lot on behavior that we had? I mean, look at the behavior PowerPoints here. If we look at them like this, we see that, you know, it's general ideas, right? Nerve networks to more complex nervous systems. The leech was really interesting. The aplysia was really interesting. Why are these simpler systems so interesting to study? Why were they so important in developing neurobiology or understanding how our nervous system works?
They're segmented, and so is our nervous system.
Yeah, they were segmented in you know, like an annelid, right, like the leech, and big cells, generally. You can put electrodes in them. And then relatively few neurons, right? So like in the leech system, which is this one, every neuron is known in that ganglion for that segment. There's only 400 neurons in there. And they could record for multiple neurons at the same time. Now they're doing it with imaging abilities. But if you activate one sensory cell, they know exactly the pathway that goes through these and then to get that motor response. So they could really have a reductionist approach to understand neural circuits, identified neurons from animal to animal. You can't really do that with rats or humans, right? Because a rat brain, you can't get that same cell every time that does that same response. So you have lots of cells, so there's some variations. So the general take-home was nerve nets to ganglia, to ganglion with known neurons that you could actually do experiments on, big cells. You could even get them out and put them in a culture dish and actually make new circuits in a culture dish. The aplysia system like this got Eric Kandel the Nobel Prize because he was a psychiatrist that then went in to understand the aplysia system, because then he wanted to understand learning and memory. He wanted to understand how animals learn, like us, our learning deficits. And he actually rebuilt circuits in a dish. And then that led to turning on genes that he could look at with the aplysia system, and those same genes are turned on in vertebrates for activity in the neurons.
Can you describe the aplysia system real quick?
Yeah, the aplysia system. Generally, the points for this guy here with the aplysia, it's this big ganglion with known cell bodies. And I think we got a picture of one of those creatures coming up here, didn't we? Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. I think I might have pulled it up on somewhere. Where is our aplysia? Where did it go? Did I have one?
I don't think so.
Oh, maybe not.
Well,
oh, maybe it was in that this crazy diagram here. No. Okay, well, we can explain it. Because in some years I hit it more. So this was the point about the visual system, the competition of the olfactory nerves that were competing in the lateral geniculate, for example. But the aplysia system, we didn't emphasize a lot of it this year, but remember, it's a sea slug, this crazy little animal, sea slug. It has this little siphon that's on it, and you could touch it just like, you know, it would withdraw, right? You repetitively touch it, it withdraws. You do it again, and it quits withdrawing. So how does it habituate to that sensory stimulation? So they were interested in that. And we talked about the tail flip, crayfish tail flip. You touch them on the tail, they tail flip, right? But you keep touching them on the tail, like we did in class. We brought that crayfish on the overhead. If you keep touching them on the tail, they stop tail flipping. Why is it? Is the sensory neurons not responding anymore? Or is it in the CNS? You know, what's happening? Is it the motor nerve, the TIG? No, it's really the sensory nerves into the CNS. There's a change in the synaptic responses. But the sensory neuron itself is still responding every time. but it's how it's integrated in the central nervous system. So you wonder how you habituate. We kind of habituate to that audio, you know, noise in the background, right? You don't pay attention to it, but if you came in and you were sensitive to everything, you'd be focusing on it, right? How do you habituate? Same kind of things, but they were studying these to understand. Well, Eric and Dale did something else that was really kind of interesting. He would electrically shock the animal right after touching the animal, the siphon withdrawal. So he could touch it, shock it, touch it, electrically shock it, touch it, electrically shock it. Now don't shock it anymore, but keep touching it. And it would keep withdrawing, keep withdrawing, keep withdrawing. So he got rid of the habituation. Well, now we got associative learning, right? So it learned that if I get touched, I'm going to get shocked. So how do you have associative learning in this simple little animal? So then he wanted to address that. And so he addressed that by genes being turned on and other things. And that then began to his foyer into mammalian nervous system and found out the same kind of genes are turned on based on activity or associative activity that worked on that neural circuit. And it's probably the way we learn too. So you want to, maybe we should shock everybody every time we do something with a, you know, if you miss it, you know. No, but you can get the idea. That's where the power of the invertebrate systems were to address these simple aspects, these behaviors that were too difficult to address in complex systems like us. That was basically it. Other questions on that part? No. So go through, you know, like the, which chapter was this, behavior?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we just, you know, the general points again. We didn't go through all that. We talked about lateral inhibition. I told you you didn't have to memorize all these on-off centers, but the idea was that that integration in the retina is how you detect light and edges of light, and you have different types of integrations, like a little brain in your retina. It's amazingly complex. So, you know, even though there's a lot of PowerPoints, so we didn't really talk too much about them, and that we talked about hearing, you know, and the owl behavior, like really neat, different ears, right, offset. Bigger ear on one side, smaller ear on the other, the way the feathers are arranged. That temporal difference from right to left, they can detect it in milliseconds and integrate and know where the little sound's coming from. Amazing that they can do that. You know, oh yes, beautiful thing. You know, for the tail flip response, one of the first behaviors described from neuron to neuron, to understand the whole animal behavior, your favorite animal, Don Kennedy, president of Stanford for 10 years, because he described that, so, you know, might make it, you know, might be there someday, who knows. And then, you know, we talked a little bit about, they just used the cardiac system, the somatogastric ganglion and lobsters to figure out how arrhythmicity occurs also, same idea. We talked about the bird brain a little bit, right? The bird brain with hormones, singing birds like canaries, right? Zebra finches, and every year, new neurons are made in that brain. That's amazing. And that they have to connect to the neural song circuit, right? They actually make new neurons and it expands and it goes into the brain. And that's driven by seasonal differences in hormones. And, you know, we talked about generally that we didn't have to know about the nitty-gritty details, but hormones, what's, you know, for the male, for singing, as you would expect, testosterone, right? So these males increase this. This was a big thing, still is a big thing, because neurons are being born and those connections are being made. How in an adult brain, how does that happen, right? If you understand this, maybe we could understand regeneration and repair or stem cells. So this is why that's so important, why people study that.
You said that it comes from testosterone in male birds?
Well,
the estradiol, is that the precursor?
Yeah, it has to have that estradiol and then the testosterone response, and it's part of it in for the birds, but I didn't want to have to worry about the nitty-gritty detail. But it needs that estradiol as well, but then the testosterone. And it's a little, there's some subtle differences with the female and the male in this whole part about the song and reception in the parts of the brain. But in general, and this is kind of a misnomer. Anybody read Raises Zebra Finches? You know, what, is that a male or a female zebra finch? It's actually a male, but they have female written there. It's kind of confusing. This is a female. We're talking about the table below, but that's a male. Because males are always prettier, right? They have all the colors. I'm just joking. Okay, so that's kind of cool. And then we talked about the last part in that chapter was, you know, it's not just the hormones, right? It's receptors that make a big difference. So the big example here that's in ecology textbooks and books around the world and relates to humans too is the arginine vasopressin receptor, right? And the receptor was the key element. So you get montane voles, prairie voles, they make arginine vasopressin, but the ones that had more of the receptors were the ones that showed more grooming behavior or maybe affection with their infant, the ones that are born, right? So social disorders were thought, this could be the problem too, why some people are aphectic that don't respond well to social behaviors, is that maybe they're lacking some of these receptors or don't want to take care of their kid after it's born, for example. So they actually took transgenic mice and they injected them to express the arginine vasopressin receptor, and they actually changed their grooming behavior or their affection behavior just by expressing the receptor for it. So now you think about, wow, maybe that's why that person doesn't respond well or something, you know, or the mother doesn't really relate to the child well. Do they have a lack of arginine vasopressin receptors? So this is where it went from my studies, field studies, all the way to mammals. And then we talked about the autonomic nervous system. We re-drilled that over and over again in multiple chapters, right, with circulatory and everything else. Where does all this come from? We talked about the spinal cord, you know, and we didn't go through all the cranial nerves. You don't have to memorize that, but, you know, the general ports of the brain. We just, you know, talked about homunculus, the sensory and motor homunculus. That's the main points we got out of that. We didn't have to memorize the different regions. This is not a neuro course. You know, and we talked about lots of facial sensation, a lot of facial motor control, right? So the homunculus relates to that. And gas, which you all are in right now, you're probably in the exhaustive phase, right? Right, we talked about like the exhaustion phase. What happens in there hormonally? What's going on with stress?
Cortisol,
which comes from where? Adrenal.
Medulla.
Cortex, right? Adrenal cortex. So if you keep releasing the cortisol, what's it doing to your blood glucose levels?
Raising
it up. How is it raising it up?
Breaking down
glycogen. So glycogenolysis and gluconeogenesis, but also you can be breaking down muscle mass, breaking down those proteins, and this is why high cortisol for long periods of time can actually break down your muscle mass, because you get the amino acids that are released that are used for energy, right? Because remember that glycolysis can be through carbohydrates, but for the TCA and electron transport chain, you can do fatty acid cycle, but you can also break down proteins to amino acids to enter into the TCA cycle, main thing to get ATP energy, right? So you're in that exhaustive phase, which you're in at this point. This is why Adderall is not good too, because sometimes you hit that when it wears off, and then right before the excess, you can't think. And then you just, and this is why truck drivers fall asleep on the road too, right? They have these accidents because they're taking amphetamines and things like that. Then all of a sudden, wham, and they've depleted all their energy stores and they don't have anything left. So you're probably in that phase. And then we've talked, you know, generally about how the sympathetic system works, right? And the different parts of the sympathetic system. You know, what did we talk about with receptors on parasympathetic? Alpha and beta receptors, right? What type of receptors are over here on the parasympathetic postganglion? Acetylcholine is a transmitter. Are they nicotinic like your skeletal muscle? How about on the heart, right? They're muscarinic receptors, right? So they're G-coupled proteins on the parasympathetic, on the, you know, on the target tissue, right? Now, which ones are nicotinic? I know it gets a little confusing, but those are always these ones in the middle. How to remember para, where it comes from? A pair. Acetylcholine, acetylcholine. Para. Parasympathetic, acetylcholine, acetylcholine. But the first one's nicotinic, the second one is muscarinic. First one's like your skeletal muscle, second one's like your heart muscle, right? How else to remember the anatomy differences? Para, cranial, sacral, para. Thoracic lumbar is your sympathetic. So para. Hopefully that helps you remember things, standardized exams too, right? Are we okay? Confusion over there? No, is it okay?
What did you say was muscarinic?
Okay, so always the first one in both of these, parasympathetic, trying to remember para, is always a pair. Thoracic, cranial, sacral. and parent acetylcholine, acetylcholine. The first one's always nicotinic. Think of it like the first thing is your alpha motor neuron, right? Boom. Now, what's so different? The autonomic nervous system is different. It has like a second order neuron. So think about the second one is different. And so the second one is different. It is muscarinic to the target tissue, like on your heart, right? Muscarinic, right? And then the sympathetic acetylcholine, norepinephrine, epinephrine, and you got two receptor subtypes, usually we call them alpha, betas. There's subtypes of those alphas and betas, but alpha and beta for the epinephrine. And so now we've finished understanding the general part of the autonomic and sympathetic nervous system. Here's that table again with the receptor subtypes. And then we're done with the behavior chapter. We just whipped up through two chapters, and you know, those were probably the two easiest ones, right? Then we got muscle, and then we have endocrine, and then we have circulatory. Circulatory, you can't forget because you just had it, right? So you have the advantage because you have this lab right now, so you don't have time to forget it compared to Monday's class where they all forget it because it's so long ago. On the skeletal muscle, so all your advantages in here. On your skeletal muscle, what do we have on the muscle chapter, not just skeletal, what do we have to remember? What are the big things? You got to know the anatomy, right? So you better draw three sarcomeres and know the anatomy. What else? Where does calcium come from in skeletal muscle? Skeletal muscle.
Sarcoplasmic
reticulum.
Extracellular fluid.
Now that is for which type of muscle?
No, that's the heart.
That's the heart and smooth muscle, right? Is smooth muscle, does it have sarcomeres? Smooth muscle, sarcomeres, banding pattern.
No, but cardiac does.
But cardiac does. So smooth muscle doesn't. Does smooth muscle use myosin and actin?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. But it's not in that kind of banding pattern that we've talked about. Calcium, cardiac, and smooth muscle, both extracellular, intracellular. Skeletal muscle, intracellular, right? Sarcoplasmic reticulum. Then you had the different types of skeletal muscle, mammalian skeletal muscle. Now, a little difference in skeletal muscle of invertebrates, crustaceans, insects, you can get calcium coming from the outside as well as the inside because they're usually very thin. They don't need the calcium to be released from inside because just diffusion is enough to get across the plasma membrane to the contractile elements. But a little subtle difference. Of the skeletal muscle types, we've talked about skeletal muscle fiber types, right?
Where did you say calcium comes from? Cardiac?
In cardiac and smooth muscle, both extracellular and intracellular. So ECF plus sarcoplasmic reticulum. But in invertebrates, generally the skeletal muscle, you can have calcium from the extracellular as well because usually it's a single cell that's not really thick, so just enough to diffuse. The reason you start to see sarcoplasmic reticulum, the idea is that as the muscle becomes thicker and thicker with all the contractile elements, calcium can't diffuse deep enough into the contractile elements. So you see in animals, they started to develop an internal organelle that can dump out calcium, sarcoplasmic reticulum. Fiber types. Think of the two extremes. What are we talking about? Red and white. Like the big fiber type differences. Dark meat, white meat, they tell you, and when you go to KFC.
Slow and fast.
The other terms.
Mitochondria.
Yeah, so which one's going to have more mitochondria?
Slow.
Which one's going to stain more for all the enzymes? For mitochondrial TCA, electron slow, right? Because more mitochondria.
Right.
And those are red, right? And so they also have more myoglobin, right? Because oxygen, and that also looks red, so that's why it's red. Which one's fatigued quicker?
Fast,
right? So you got it down. You see, you kind of, like, there's a lot there, and you're stressed, and you're getting lost in the forest. But back up a little bit, and you see the big picture. It's not too crazy, right? But so make sure you see the big picture and then kind of go into the nitty-gritties. Was there any question on old exams? So look through the old exams too. It's very helpful. But when you do that, cover up your answers, right? Read the question first, kind of answer it yourself, and then see, oh, was my answer there, right? And that way it's not just kind of trying to memorize, but you really know the material a lot better. All right. Does that help? Any? Glad to answer any detailed questions.
So, doesn't have sarcomeres?
Oh, no, it does.
It does.
Cardiac does. Skeletal and cardiac has sarcomeres, but, you know, the kind of the arrangements in the cardiac, it's not all like that. The fibers go different, but each fiber has the sarcomeres, right? Smooth muscle, you don't see sarcomeres generally, but it still has myosin and actin for contraction. And it's weird with the calcium, and I didn't want to get into the fine details of muscle contraction, smooth muscle, but generally calcium is important too, but it still uses myosin and actin. Well, I think what I mentioned yesterday, I think what to do is to try to make it where we have our bonus points in there already built in. So maybe 106, 104, 106%, you know, test. So when you think about, let's say it's 100, you know, percent. So you, to make it manageable in the hour and a half, let's say 50 questions, right, and 2 points each. The problem with just having the 50 questions, if you miss two, there's 4 points. You miss four, there's 8 points, right, and then you're starting to stress. But if you know that you have 106 points, or 104, 106 points, then you kind of have that little buffer and you're not so stressed out by missing one question, right? But every question does add up quickly with 2 points, 2 points. So, you know, probably what we'll make is like 54 questions or something like that, right? Or 53 questions. Yeah, yeah. I'll try to have some short answers. But I can't make them too long because then people go crazy and they write paragraphs and then they don't answer all the short answer, the multiple choice questions, right? But we want you to finish in an hour and a half without being stressed, right? So some of you will finish very quickly and do quite well, and because you've got the answers and you didn't stay up all night, you didn't do Adderall, and you're not, you know, zonked out.
Did you say our test is an hour and a half?
Or an hour and 15 minutes, whatever, you know, the whole time period.
There's a question on skeletal, on action potentials, where it has the little action potential and then the big action potential.
Okay.
And...
oh, those were back on maybe...
you think it's from the first?
Yeah, that was probably graded responses maybe on sensory endings, right? And we talked about how you could get it bigger, more vesicles would fuse to get to a threshold.
It says something about counts.
Yeah, that's like the... on the muscle fiber, if you record it in the muscle fiber, sub-threshold. Sub-threshold. Let's say this is threshold. Okay, here. And here's a nerve, and here's a muscle fiber, and you put an intracellular electrode in the muscle fiber. You release one vesicle, what do you get? A little, you know, some transmitter, and you get a little depolarization, let's say it's your neuromuscular junction. Release two vesicles, you get a bigger depolarization. Three vesicles, more. Maybe let's say 10 vesicles all at once. Finally, you get above threshold, and boom, you hit the action potential in your skeletal muscle. So that,
it's like a stepwise.
Yeah, it's like that stepwise until threshold. And that's the way our muscles work in the mammalian system. Now, invertebrates, like the crayfish, they only work, most of the muscle fibers are graded. So the more vesicles that fuse, the bigger depolarization. But the other point was, in those old exams, were if you stimulated one time and another time, the first one might be kind of smaller, and you repetitively stimulate, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, what happens? That is facilitation. It's not spiking, but it's because of residual calcium building up in the nerve terminal, which is referred to as short-term facilitation, right? That was the first exam that we covered. And that's how your brain works, but it works in the invertebrate system, like in the skeletal muscle of crayfish, like that, because it doesn't make action potentials. It's kind of like your brain, your dendrites in your brain. If you get more transmitter, you can get a bigger graded response, and it can actually be bigger after a train of stimuli comes in, because this neuron is building up calcium residually. So the next time it fires, it's already building on residual calcium, so you get more vesicles to fuse to get a bigger response. So that dendrite is like the neuromuscular junction on a crayfish. That's why they use the crustacean system or the insect system to try to understand synaptic transmission. So that's kind of cool, right? Those are good things to go.
So invertebrates don't have action potentials in skeletal muscles?
A lot of them don't. Some do. Some do. So they just use it as a model to understand synaptic transmission. So I'll try to stay up till, you know, midnight or so and answer, you know, drastic questions that anybody has, freaking out. But if you're just, you know, copying an old question, you know, try to answer it yourself first. Well, I think it's this A or B, but I don't really know. Can you help me out? You know, I think it's this, and then we'll work with you, okay? All right. But I have to go to bed sometime, unlike y'all getting old. Okay, are we good?
All right. There was also a question that said that lives are wrong to bother. And I know it's because the nerve comes out.
Yeah.
But one of the options was a lack of rods and cones, if that's also true.
Yes,
right?
That's right. Yeah.